content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. When we look back on the year 2020, there's no doubt that the coronavirus pandemic will be among the biggest stories of the year. Since March, when COVID-19 began to take its toll around the globe, many of the stories we've aired on Armchair Traveler have included how the pandemic is affecting communities and travelers alike. But there is another story that remains in the headlines. It's a story that dates back many, many decades before 2020. Its focal theme is racism. Like COVID-19, racism also impacts travel. College professor and journalist Ron Stodgill shares his firsthand experience of what it's like to travel black behind the wheel. Now, his story appeared in the July 14, 2020 issue of the New York Times. Driving across Woodward Avenue in Detroit a few weeks ago amid a spirited George Floyd demonstration, this one a 30-mile motorcade into the suburbs billed as the I Have a Dream protest cruise, my mind drifted strangely to an empty two-lane highway in Arkansas near the Texas border. The memory was jarring, sweeping me away from this raucous caravan, honking horns, black power fists thrust from car windows, the whir of sirens, back to my youth in the spring of 1986. 22 years old, fresh out of college, and cruising into one of the prettiest sunsets I'd ever seen, I was nearing the end of my 1,200-mile journey from Detroit to a summer reporting gig in Dallas. Somewhere outside Texarkana, Arkansas, the sun perched on the nose of my Honda Accord and guided me for miles like some mystical hood ornament. The moment was exhilarating. Enveloped in the dusky light, the narrow highway rushing toward me, Stevie Wonder's Hotter Than July cranked high, I felt a new kind of freedom, the sort I'd only witnessed in those white boy coming-of-age films like The Graduate. That is, until I heard the shrill siren of a patrol car and saw flashing lights in my rearview mirror. I cut off my music and pulled to the side of the highway. A white patrolman, hands on his holster, moved toward my vehicle. The flat, endless horizon and dusky light took me on a surreal aura. I was petrified. When the patrolman asked for my license and registration and where I was going, I channeled my elders. I kept my hands visible and was performatively polite, even reverential. This routine always fills me with self-contempt, but here on this lonely highway it seemed to be working. The policeman disappeared into his patrol car and left me waiting and waiting. Eventually, he returned and without a word handed me my ID and walked off. I sat there for a few moments, shaken. I lived, but a part of me died that day. Few relationships in America are as complex as the black man and his automobile. As a native Detroiter, my affection for cars, from the intricacy of their machinery to their potent mythology, is hardwired into my psyche. Both of my grandfathers worked in auto factories, Oldsmobiles on my mother's side and Buicks on my dad's. Their labor would pave our way into the middle class, or at least in aspiration. Family vacations were road trips, movies were drive-ins. Saturday pastimes were me and my buddies sitting on the curb gazing dreamily at passing cars, claiming the coolest, most decked-out Corvettes, Mustangs, Transams, and Cadillacs as our own. By the time we were teenagers, our creed was simple. Your ride pretty much defined you and where you were going in life. Your car was your currency in work, leisure, and yes, romance. On dates, Smokey Robinson's Motown suave balladeer told our truth. You're gonna fly away. Glad you're going my way. I love it when we're cruising together. But when you're black in America, you also paradoxically learn to distrust, fear even, that lovely machine preening in your driveway. You learn the hard way the perils of hitting the road, that those beckoning back streets, city boulevards, and wide-open highways are not always routes of thrilling adventure and escape as advertised, but rather places where black people all too often die or greatly suffer at the hands of racist whites. It's our cars, hyped up in such American values as freedom, mobility, and adventure, that reveal the falsity of these ideals, even in the basic routines of daily life. Think of Philando Castile in Minneapolis, Samuel DuBose in Cincinnati, Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, just a few among the generations of black men who were fatally gunned down by the police during traffic stops. The gangster-like brutality of so many American police officers, one hopes, is finally turning on itself. That Sunday afternoon in Detroit, the stream of cars, from convertible coupes to pickup trucks to minivans snaking along Woodward Avenue to protest George Floyd's death, seemed infinite. On both sides of the street, pedestrians and shop owners stood cheering, some with fists held high and others waving placards, "Black Lives Matter, No Justice, No Peace." I can't breathe. As we began our journey from downtown Detroit north into Oakland County, its whiter, wealthier neighbor, on the road. A few days earlier, I had left Columbia, Missouri, where I live and teach journalism at the University of Missouri, to drive to my hometown. My trips across the so-called show-me state are always tense. A few years ago, the NAACP issued a travel advisory on Missouri as unsafe for people of color, an advisory that has yet to be lifted. As Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP, put it when initiating the advisory, the numerous racist incidents and the statistics cited by the Missouri Attorney General in the advisory, namely the fact that African Americans in Missouri are 75% more likely to be stopped and searched by law enforcement officers than Caucasians, are unconscionable and are simply unacceptable in a progressive society. The University of Missouri is also my college alma mater. And so my experiences traveling from the state's roads go deep. Back in the mid-1980s, I remember heading back to Columbia from St. Louis with four buddies, all of us African-American, after a spring break. Packed merrily into my friend's beater, an old Ford Pinto, we headed into Jennings, a mostly black North St. Louis County community, heavily patrolled by white officers, to pick up one more college friend. The moment we pulled off the ramp, I got a bad feeling. It's like its neighboring community of Ferguson. Some three decades later, local police would fatally shoot 18-year-old Michael Brown there. Jennings had a reputation for police meeting quotas by ticketing and arresting blacks. Moments later, a siren sounded, and there we were, leaning spread-eagle against my buddy's car as a couple of white policemen frisked us for weapons and drugs. They ran my friend's license plates and searched his car. Apparently, he had several unpaid parking tickets. The police cuffed him, put him in a squad car, and told the rest of us that we were free to leave. Of course, we had no ride now. A friend's sister dropped us off at the downtown Greyhound station. We got back to Columbia so late that I slept through an early morning exam. Now, in 2020, behind the wheel of a late model Dodge Ram truck, I drove across the flat rural plains of central Missouri, flanked by acres of farmland stretching infinitely into the distance and the occasional sight of cattle grazing under hazy morning skies. My vehicle suited the setting. It's a curious thing. After years of sporting sedans, I bought the pickup about a year ago, partly for the extra cargo space, but also to avoid drawing the attention of Missouri police. In a region where pickup trucks are status quo, the Ram, I suppose, is my rather sad attempt at vehicular camouflage. Perhaps it's a coincidence, and I'm sure I'll regret thinking this, but I haven't had any run-ins yet with the law in my truck, only lots of locals pulling up beside me at stoplights to offer the, "Wow, there's a black man in a pickup," thumbs up. Heading east on I-70, with the St. Louis Gateway Arch looming over the Mississippi River, I settled in as the skies brightened. I crossed the state line into Illinois, and around noon I pulled off at a gas station to fill my tank. I had packed plenty of food and drinks to minimize going into public places and contracting the coronavirus, but there was no way to minimize the tedium of sanitation on road trips, the masks, the wiping of hands and handles and knobs as I got in and out of the car. Walking through the gas station toward the restroom, I noted that less than half the patrons wore a mask. Minutes later, I was back on the highway, sailing past a blur of farms, fast food restaurants, and truck stops. I once lived in Illinois and Chicago, and as I drove along the interstate, the thought of stopping for a meal, perhaps looking up some old friends, occurred to me. But I was weary about lingering. According to a 2019 report by the American Civil Liberties Union, black and Latino drivers in Illinois were more likely to be asked to be searched by police, even though they were less likely to be found with contraband during consent searches than white drivers. In recent years, Chicago police have more than tripled their traffic stops, with black drivers accounting for the majority of this increase. So the decision was simple. I was making good time on my trip to Detroit, and I kept driving. This kind of calculus is perhaps unique to black drivers in America. Yet here's the sad irony. Historically, our cars were viewed as our best refuge against white violence and aggression while traveling. After emancipation, all the way through the 1950s and 60s, we relied largely on public transportation, whether it was buses, trolleys, or trains, and coupled with verbal and physical harassment, suffered the indignities of separate inferior service. The mass production of the automobile was a game-changer for African Americans. As the prominent economist and sociologist Gunnar Myrdal, whose studies on the American racial divide led to a Nobel Prize, wrote in 1944, "The cheap automobile has meant for Southern Negroes who can afford one a partial emancipation from Jim Crowism." Still, I remember a colleague telling a story of heading north from the Carolinas for family vacations. His father, an Army veteran, would wear his uniform in the sweltering summer heat for the entire drive, hoping his patriotic service would prevent police harassment. But service to your country didn't matter most of the time. Back in 1946, Sergeant Isaac Woodard, Jr., a 26-year-old decorated World War II veteran, hopped on a Greyhound bus hours after being honorably discharged from military service. In South Carolina, he somehow wound up in an argument with another passenger, and the cop showed up, accused him of public drunkenness, and beat him so bad that he was permanently blinded. The case, fraught with racial hatred, was said to have been a catalyst behind Harry S. Truman's drive to integrate the U.S. military. In those days, Victor Hugo Green, a postal worker turned travel writer, was viewed as a kind of savior. His self-published The Negro Traveler's Green Book provided an exhaustive review of stores, motels, and gas stations that offered services to blacks, greatly easing our mobility and avoiding white violence. There were other such guides, such as Hackley and Harrison's Hotel and Apartment Guide for Colored Travelers, and Grayson's Guide, the Go Guide to Pleasant Motoring, but the Green Book was considered the Bible for black travelers. Despite his book's popularity, Green hoped that better times would one day put him out of business. "There will be a day, sometime in the future, when this guide will not have to be published," he wrote. "That is when we as a race will have equal opportunities and privileges in the United States." Detroit in a sobering light. Some 10 hours later, I arrived in the Detroit area and spent the evening with my father in the northern suburbs. I awoke early and headed into the city, noting from the freeway impoverished neighborhoods, boarded storefronts, abandoned houses, lots full of weeds, that looked unchanged since my childhood. It all cast a more sobering light on the city than headlines I'd read in recent years, which mostly trumpet Detroit's comeback after bankruptcy in 2013. To be sure, the glitzy entertainment venues downtown and block after block of trendy new restaurants and bars have added a cosmopolitan sheen. Still, it's hard to celebrate amenities aimed at white suburbanites and hipsters when Detroit's neighborhoods and schools, mostly black, are largely crumbling. As I pulled into the gentrifying Cass Corridor area, where protesters' cars were lining up for the motorcade, I witnessed block by block the juxtaposition of poverty and new development that has only stoked long-simmering racial distrust. In truth, I had not planned to spend much time in Detroit, but rather holed up in the woods 3 hours north, restoring our family cottage in Idyllwild, Michigan, a historic African-American resort. But there was no escaping the rage around George Floyd's murder. Nearly everyone I knew was protesting somewhere in the country. That furor landed me in the middle of the caravan of vehicles on Woodward Avenue. While there were protests across the city that weekend, this one was, by comparison, decidedly middle-aged, Motor City-styled, and given our cars as pandemic-proof as possible. It was the brainchild of my childhood friend, J.D. Simpson, who felt a pang of guilt for letting COVID-19 get in the way of supporting his 18-year-old daughter and her friends who were leading demonstrations elsewhere. Honking their horns from the safety of their cars, thousands of men and women, black and white, inched their way north until we exited Detroit's city limits and moved deep into the white suburbs of leafy, manicured Oakland County. Now that we were here, the mood of the protest shifted. There were fewer supporters and spectators cheering us on, fewer police escorts moving alongside. The crowds had been reduced to mostly gawkers with an occasional hipster fist pump. In the gridlock, I marveled at all the beautiful automobiles surrounding me, all the miles behind and ahead of us. On my radio, I heard the swelling bass line of Marvin Gaye's protest classic Intercity Blues, and turned it up loud, letting his ache, now a half-century-old, pump out into the suburban air. Yeah, it makes me want to holler and throw up both my hands. Crime is increasing, trigger-happy policing, panic is spreading. God knows where we're heading. Cruising into affluent Bloomfield Hills, I noticed a white man, perhaps in his 70s, standing at the wrought-iron entrance of a subdivision. Our eyes locked, his fist went up. I honked my horn. Well, road trips have become among the most popular ways for people to get away from home and take a break from the shelter-in-place environment most of us have been experiencing since March. Amy Tara Koch decided to take a road trip earlier this year. She says, "I wasn't looking for an exotic vacation, just a temporary reprieve from compulsive news watching and a dose of in-person fun with family and friends." She shares her experience in her article, "Road Trips Are Great, Except for the Driving," which appeared in the July 24th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. I am in the Catskills in a charming tucked-away treehouse of an inn. My room, walking distance to hiking trails, overlooks a waterfall. Morning coffee and evening vodka tonic are taken on the deck, where the temperature clocks in at a marvelous 75 degrees. Owls hoot, birds chirp, wind tickles my legs. During the coronavirus lockdown in Chicago, I dreamed about getting away to this leafy utopia. What I did not envision was the hell of crossing the country by car. During difficult times, I always plant a light at the end of the tunnel, a bright and shiny experience to make the tough moments more tolerable and a positive attitude more attainable. Even for those lucky enough to keep their jobs and their good health, the pandemic has been a very difficult time. To get away, to blunt the anxiety that this disease has wreaked upon us, I wanted a change of scenery. Since I couldn't get to the Amalfi Coast and wouldn't board a domestic flight, it was easy to buy into the hoopla surrounding the All-American road trip. I wasn't looking for an exotic vacation, just a temporary reprieve from compulsive news watching and a dose of in-person fun with family and friends. Once I committed to the getaway, I felt excited for the first time since mid-March. I was escaping to multiple destinations, and I was going alone. My husband Peter was busy with work, and my teenage kids wanted to hang out with their friend Pod outside by the lake. Fine by me, the prospect of leaving behind routine and responsibility, meal planning specifically, was heavenly. The itinerary was ambitious. Peter would drive me to Pittsburgh, where we would stop for the night and pick up my rental car. I would then continue to Washington, D.C. to visit my sister, on to a friend in Connecticut, over to the Catskills, and end at a lovely retreat in the Hamptons. All of us had taken the lockdown seriously and agreed to social distance during my visit. "Would it be too much driving?" Peter asked. He knew how badly my back throbbed even after a quickie flight to New York. "I'll just bring Thermacare," I replied breezily, knowing full well that he was right. I was not going to let an annoying detail like chronic back pain get in my way. I planned to cruise along scenic byways to a soundtrack of Bob Dylan, Miles Davis, and Journey. I would stop for adorable farm stands and pastoral picnics. I would stretch in the shade of giant sycamore trees. Like me, the other travelers would be respectfully clad in masks. The first whiff of anxiety came as I gathered my hygiene arsenal, a go-bag filled with gloves, masks, Clorox wipes, and multiple purse-sized Purell bottles. There was a deadly virus out there, and I could be exposed to it. Was I being reckless? I tossed emergency packets and a quart-sized plastic bag filled with vitamin supplements into the bag. A strong immunity system was another layer of armor. Chicago to Pittsburgh. And it was time for Peter and me to hit the road. My left brain did not compute that the first 462 miles would be on toll roads with scenery about as thrilling as a Boca Raton office park. Bathroom breaks were an even greater obstacle. For coffee lovers, hours in the car means endless pit stops. My preference would have been to skedaddle behind a tree, but even if you did risk pulling over, it turns out that these toll roads are lined with barriers with few tree-shaded nooks. So on the hour, we pulled the car into a rest stop, and I donned my mask and gloves, speed-walked into the ladies' room, flushed with my foot, and sprinted out of the stall, holding my breath. Somewhere in Indiana, I got the brilliant idea to exit the highway in search of an iced latte and more glamorous toilet. This detour ended at Cracker Barrel, which was a nicer option, but not worth the 30 minutes we then spent idling at a broken toll booth. Lesson learned. Pittsburgh to Washington. After 8 hours, we made it to Pittsburgh, where I picked up a Toyota 4Runner equipped with an Easy Pass and not much else. Car rental companies claim an increase in coronavirus cleaning protocols, but my car had what looked like blueberry muffin residue caked to the gears and the seats. When I pointed this out, the cleaning crew took another pass. I still wiped every surface down with Clorox, encased the driver's seat with a seat cover. I used these on planes, too, and placed a towel on the passenger seat. I didn't notice the dank Marlboro scent or a broken Bluetooth system until I had driven away. This was not part of the plan. Even when I plugged my phone into the car and pressed go on the Maps app, no audio could be heard from the car speakers. Would I have to drive the next 246 miles without voice-guided navigation? That would not be good for me. I could, however, access Siri's dulcet tone directions when the phone was not plugged in, so I'd drive with the phone on speaker and deal with a drained battery every 80 minutes or so. To preserve power, I'd need to swap my classic rock playlist for local radio. Another crack in my fantasy. However, this first leg of solo driving wasn't bad, save the music situation and the undercurrent of anxiety I felt each time I had to use the bathroom or fuel up. I was off the dull, never-changing Midwestern roads. Pennsylvania rest stops were shaded and pleasant. Each hour, I whipped out my elastic workout band to stretch. In 4 hours, I was at my sister's house, and the next few days were spent hiking, cooking, and singing karaoke to 1980s songs. Washington to Connecticut. Next up, the Connecticut town of Sharon. Google Maps had the 321-mile leg at 5.5 hours, which I rounded down to 5 hours. I tend to speed. When I hoisted myself into the driver's seat, I practically retched. The humidity had intensified the car's rank smell, and despite the burning heat, I had to roll down all the windows. Thankfully, a decent rock station helped me deal with an hour's worth of traffic as I left Washington. But then MapQuest directed me to change highways in what felt like every few miles. Through Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, and New York, the ride required hyper-attentiveness, something I had in short supply since my sister's smoke detector had gone off at 2 a.m. After 2 hours, even with the Salon Pas pain patches affixed to my shoulders, I felt the telltale spasm at my scapula. It would inevitably explode into migraine-like waves of pain radiating from my neck to my tailbone. When it did, I had to pull over. I washed down 3 Advil and fished out the tennis ball I use as a massage tool and jammed it under my shoulder. On top of this pain, my phone drained every so often, forcing me to plug in and glance down at directions while driving, something I don't recommend. This happened precisely as I hit busy interchanges outside New York City. Major Deegan, Cross Bronx Expressway, I-87, I-95. One wrong turn and I'd be caught in an off-ramp cycle for hours. Here, I was grateful for the surprising glut of cars. The traffic gave me just enough time to glance down and scan Siri's directive. Finally, I noted signs for Connecticut. Almost there, I told myself. Just as I started to relax, I saw that I was back in New York. I pulled over to consult the GPS. Had I spaced and made a wrong turn? I hadn't. Sharon is in the northwest corner of Connecticut, so there is a crisscross situation at the state's borders. I arrived at my friend's home, looking and smelling as if I'd run a marathon. The drive had taken 7 hours. Thankfully, she had chilled wine at the ready. Connecticut to the Catskills. A few days later, relaxed and revived, I got back into the car. This time I had wisely left the windows open overnight and headed north to the Catskills, an easy hour's drive that took me past the bucolic farms of Dutchess County and into the Hudson Valley. When I got to Woodstock Way Hotel, it was just as I'd remembered, a perfect hideaway. I hiked and dined with my cousins. At the farm of my oldest friend, Marcy, I had a glorious picnic alongside ripening tomatoes upon socially distanced blankets. I had swaths of time to read and write. Things felt almost normal, save for the very odd bits, like watching my martini being shaken by a masked and gloved bartender, and the 7 a.m. wait for coffee with mass socially distanced locals outside a rural bakery. As usual, once again, I began moving around. My back pain receded. I was tempted to book a massage, but decided that good old yoga and my tennis ball would suffice. I axed the Hamptons for my trip. I could not endure the 5 hours it would add to my return drive to Chicago. Ever the thoughtful friend, Marcy snipped a bouquet of lavender, mint, and lemon balm and plopped it into the Toyota's glove holder, a farm-fresh flourish to combat the car's malodorous funk for my last long drive. Get me home. On the day of my departure, I took an early hike through the Ashokan Rail Trail and hit the road by 11:30 a.m. It drizzled as I was leaving New York. Mother Nature waited until I was in the Pocono Mountains to send golf ball-sized hail to crash down with such intensity I thought the windshield might crack. This was terrifying, even though I was used to driving in blizzards in Chicago. I flicked on the hazard lights and made my way but to the side of the road. Visibility was zero. I waited for 30 minutes, using the time to charge the phone and down a bottle of water spiked with Emergen-C, something I knew would increase my intimacy with rest stops along I-84. Though scenic, the drive was supremely boring. My thoughts invariably shifted to the state of the world. Would my daughter Bella be able to attend college as planned? What would that look like with pandemic parameters? Would my other daughter, Brett, have a normal high school experience with remote learning? Would the virus reach its tentacles deep within 2021? Was a vaccine forthcoming? Who would win the election in November? The speculation and angst was tiring. The Connecticut lake had primed me for at-the-wheel exhaustion, and this time I was prepared. I picked up a facial mist spray and spritzed it on my neck and cheeks every few minutes. This and iced coffee kept me alert, though the stabbing back pain remained a constant companion. At 7 p.m., I staggered into the hotel, oozing eau de tiger balm. I was thrilled to see my husband after 10 days and relieved to bid adieu to the driving ordeal. The next day's road trip back to Chicago was uneventful. I mostly reclined and slept. Was it worth the slept? Yes. FaceTime and Zoom are not substitutes for spending quality time with friends and family. I was lucky enough to be in a position to visit them while staying within the health guidelines, something I know not everyone can do. The in-person's connections and putting the darkness of lockdown in the rearview mirror gave me the reboot that I needed. But driving across the country alone is a one-and-done experience. Hypervigilance was draining. That night and for the next 3 nights, I slept for 10 hours. By the way, Amy Tara Koch is based in Chicago, and she writes about travel, style, food, and parenting. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.